Hello and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. All of our audio is there. Completed books with commentary and some other. Today we're going to resume with Hector Human Row, The Complete Stories of Saki, and we're doing the novel The Unbearable Bassington. Today we'll do chapters 7 and 8. Seems best to keep taking these two at a time, and the whole novel's about 90 pages, so let's get started. Chapter 7, The Unbearable Bassington, Chapter 7. Towards 4 o'clock on a hot afternoon, Francesca stepped out from a shop entrance near the Piccadilly end of Bond Street and ran almost into the arms of Merla Blathlington. The afternoon seemed to get instantly hotter. Merla was one of those human flies that buzz in crowded streets, at bazaars, and in warm weather. She attained the proportions of a human bluebottle. Lady Caroline Benarsk had openly predicted that a special flypaper was being reserved for her accommodation in another world. Hell. Others, however, held the opinion that she would be miraculously multiplied in a future state, and that four or more Merla Blathlingtons, according to deserts, would be in perpetual and unremitting attendance on each lost soul. "Here we are," she cried with a glad, eager buzz, "popping in and out of shops like rabbits." Not that rabbits do pop in and out of shops very extensively. It was evidently one of her blue bottle days. "Don't you love Bond Street?" she gabbled on. "There's something so unusual and distinctive about it. No other street anywhere else is quite like it. Don't you know those icons and images and things scattered up and down Europe that are supposed to have been painted or carved, as the case may be, by St. Luke or Zacchaeus or somebody of that sort? I always like to think that some notable person of those times designed Bond Street. St. Paul, perhaps. He traveled about a lot." "Not in Middlesex, though," said Francesca. "One can't be sure," persisted Merla. "When one wanders about as much as he did, one gets mixed up and forgets where one has been. I can never remember whether I've been to the Tyrol twice and St. Moritz once or the other way around. I always have to ask my maid. And there's something about the name Bond that suggests St. Paul. Didn't he write a lot about the bond and the free?" "I fancy he wrote in Hebrew or Greek," objected Francesca. "The word wouldn't have the least resemblance." "So dreadfully noncommittal to go about pamphleteering in those bizarre languages," complained Merla. "That's what makes all those people so elusive. As soon as you try to pin them down to a definite statement about anything, you're told that some vitally important word has 15 other meanings in the original. I wonder our cabinet ministers and politicians don't adopt a sort of dog Latin or Esperanto jargon to deliver their speeches in. What a lot of subsequent explaining away would be saved. But to go back to Bond Street, not that we left it." "I'm afraid I must leave it now," said Francesca, preparing to turn up Grafton Street. "Goodbye." "Must you be going? Come and have some tea somewhere. I know of a cozy little place where one can talk undisturbed." Francesca repressed a shudder and pleaded an urgent engagement. "I know where you're going," said Merla, with the resentful buzz of a blue bottle that finds itself thwarted by the cold, unreasoning resistance of a window pane. "You're going to play bridge at Serena Golackley's. She never asked me to her bridge parties." Francesca shuddered openly this time. The prospect of having to play bridge anywhere in the near neighborhood of Merla's voice was not one that could be contemplated with ordinary calmness. "Goodbye," she said again firmly and passed out of earshot. It was rather like leaving the machinery section of an exhibition. Merla's diagnosis of her destination had been a correct one. Francesca made her way slowly through the hot streets in the direction of Serena Golackley's house on the far side of Berkeley Square. To the blessed certainty of finding a game of bridge, she hopefully added the possibility of hearing some fragments of news which might prove interesting and enlightening, and of enlightenment on a particular subject in which she was acutely and personally interested. She stood in some need. Comus, of late, had been provokingly reticent as to his movements and doings, partly perhaps because it was his nature to be provoking, partly because the daily bickerings over money matters were gradually choking other forms of conversation. Francesca had seen him once or twice in the park in the desirable company of Elaine de Fry, as we heard last chapter, and from time to time she heard of the young people as having danced together at various houses. On the other hand, she had seen and heard quite as much evidence to connect the heiress's name with that of Courtenay Ugel. Beyond this meager and conflicting and altogether tantalizing information, her knowledge of the present position of affairs did not go. If either of the young men was seriously making the running in tweezers, it was probable that she would hear some sly hint or open comment about it from one of Serena's gossip-laden friends, without having to go out of her way to introduce the subject and unduly disclose her own state of ignorance. Perhaps interest as well. And a game of bridge, played for moderately high points, gave ample excuse for convenient lapses into reticence if questions took an embarrassingly inquisitive turn. One could always find refuge in a defensive spade. The afternoon was too warm to make bridge a generally popular diversion, and Serena's party was a comparatively small one. Only one table was incomplete when Francesca made her appearance in the scene, as it was seated Serena herself, confronted by Ada Spelvexit, whom everyone was wont to explain as one of the Cheshire Spelvexits, as though any other variety would have been intolerable. Ada Spelvexit was one of those naturally stagnant souls who take infinite pleasure in what are called movements. "Most of the really great lessons I have learned have been taught me by the poor," was one of her favorite statements. The one great lesson that the poor in general would have liked to have taught her, that their kitchens and sick rooms were not unreservedly at her disposal as private lecture halls, she had never been able to assimilate. She was ready to give them unlimited advice as to how they should keep the wolf from their doors, but in return she claimed and enforced for herself the penetrating powers of an east wind or a dust storm. Her visits among her wealthier acquaintances were equally extensive and enterprising, and hardly more welcome. In country house parties, while partaking to the fullest extent of the hospitality afforded her, or offered her, she made a practice of unburdening herself of homilies, sermons, lectures, on the evils of leisure and luxury, which did not particularly endear her to her fellow guests. So she likes to lecture rich and poor alike. Hostesses regarded her philosophically as a form of social measles which everyone had to have once. The third prospective player, Francesca noted without any special enthusiasm, was Lady Caroline Benaresque. Lady Caroline was far from being a remarkably good bridge player, but she always managed to domineer mercilessly over any table that was favored with her presence, and generally managed to win. A domineering player usually inflicts the chief damage and demoralization on his partner. Lady Caroline's special achievement was to harass and demoralize partner and opponents alike. "Week in week," she announced in her gentle voice as she cut her hostess for a partner, "I suppose we had better play only 5 shillings a hundred. Francesca wondered at the old woman's moderate assessment of the stake, knowing her fondness for highish play and her usual luck in card-holding. "I don't mind what we play," said Ada Spelvexit with an incautious parade of elegant indifference. As a matter of fact, she was inwardly relieved and rejoicing at the reasonable figure proposed by Lady Caroline, and she would certainly have demurred if a higher stake had been suggested. She was not, as a rule, a successful player, and money lost at cards was always a poignant bereavement to her. "Then, as you don't mind, we'll make it 10 shillings a hundred, said Lady Caroline, with the pleased chuckle of one who has spread a net in sight of a bird and disproved the vanity of the proceeding. It proved a tiresome ding-dong rubber, with the strength of the card slightly on Francesca's side and the luck of the table going mostly the other way. She was too keen a player not to feel a certain absorption in the game once it had started, but she was conscious today of a distracting interest that competed with the momentary importance of leads and discards and declarations. The little accumulations of talk that were unpent during the dealing of the hands became as noteworthy to her alert attention as the play of the hands themselves. Yes, quite a small party this afternoon, said Serena, in a reply to a seemingly casual remark on Francesca's part, and two or three non-players, which is unusual on a Wednesday. Canon Besomley was just here before you came, you know, the big preaching man. I've been to hear him scold the human race once or twice, said Francesca. A strong man with a wonderfully strong message, said Ada Spelvexit in an impressive and assertive tone. The sort of popular pulpiteer who spanks the vices of his age and lunches with them afterwards, said Lady Caroline. Hardly a fair summary of the man and his work, protested Ada. I've been to hear him many times when I've been depressed or discouraged, and I simply can't tell you of the impression his words leave. At least you can tell us what you intend to make trumps, broke in Lady Caroline gently. Diamonds, pronounced Ada after a rather flurried survey of her hand. Double, said Lady Caroline, with increased gentleness, and a few minutes later she was penciling an addition of 24 to her score. I stayed with his people down here in Herefordshire last May, said Ada, returning to the unfinished theme of the canon. Such an exquisite rural retreat. Exquisite, they might say in Britain. And so restful and healing, too, to the nerves. Real country scenery, apple blossom everywhere. Surely only on the apple trees, said Lady Caroline. Ada Spelvexit gave up the attempt to reproduce the decorative setting of the canon's home life and fell back on the small but practical consolation of scoring the odd trick in her opponent's declaration of hearts. If you had led your highest club to start with instead of the nine, we should have saved the trick, remarked Lady Caroline to her partner in a tone of coldly gentle reproof. It's no use, my dear, she continued, as Serena flustered an halting apology. No earthly use to attempt to play bridge at one table and try to see and hear what's going on at two or three other tables. I can generally manage to attend to more than one thing at a time, said Serena rashly. I think I must have a sort of double brain. Much better to economize and have one really good one, observed Lady Caroline. La belle dame sans merci, scoring a verbal trick or two as usual, said a player at another table in a discreet undertone. Did I tell you Sir Edward Roan is coming to my next big evening? Said Serena hurriedly, by way of perhaps restoring herself a little in her own esteem. Poor dear good Sir Edward. What have you made trumps? Asked Lady Caroline in one breath. Clubs, said Francesca, and pray, why these adjectives of commiseration? Francesca was a ministerialist by family interest and allegiance and was inclined to take up the cudgels, as she suggested, at the suggested disparagement aimed at the foreign secretary. He amuses me so much, purred Lady Caroline. Her amusement was usually of the sort that a sporting cat derives from watching the Swedish exercises of a well-spent and carefully thought-out mouse. Really? He has been a rather brilliant success at the Foreign Office, you know, said Francesca. He reminds one so of a circus elephant, infinitely more intelligent than the people who direct him, but quite content to go on putting his foot down or taking it up as may be required, quite unconcerned whether he steps on a meringue or on a hornet's nest in the process of going where he's expected to go. How can you say such things? Protested Francesca. I can't, said Lady Caroline. Courtney Ugel said it in the House last night. Didn't you read the debate? It was really rather informed. I disagree entirely with his point of view, of course, but some of the things he says have just enough truth behind them to redeem them from being merely smart. For instance, his summing up of the government's attitude towards our embarrassing colonial empire in the wistful phrase, "Happy is the country that has no geography." What an absurdly unjust thing to say, put in Francesca. I dare say some of us at our party at some time have taken up that attitude, but everyone knows that Sir Edward is a sound imperialist at heart. Most politicians are something or other at heart, but no one would be rash enough to insure a politician against heart failure, particularly when he happens to be in office. Anyhow, I don't see that the opposition leaders would have acted any differently in the present case, said Francesca. One should always speak guardedly of the opposition leaders, said Lady Caroline in her gentlest voice. One never knows what a turn in the situation may do for them. You mean they may one day be at the head of affairs? Asked Serena briskly. I mean they may one day lead the opposition. One never knows. Lady Caroline had just remembered that her hostess was on the opposition side in politics. Francesca and her partner scored 4 tricks in clubs. The game stood irresolutely at 24-all. If you had followed the excellent lyrical advice given to the Maid of Athens and returned to my heart, we should have made 2 more tricks and gone game, said Lady Caroline to her partner. Mr. Ugel seems pushing himself to the fore of late, remarked Francesca as Serena took up the cards to deal. Since a young politician's name had been introduced into their conversation, the opportunity for turning the talk more directly on him and his affairs was too good to be missed. And see how all these people are a family and they know each other. It's a real nation, even with Jews woven through it. I think he's got a career before him, said Serena. The house always fills when he's speaking, and that's a good sign. And then he's young and got rather an attractive personality, which is always something in the political world. His lack of money will handicap him, unless he can find himself a rich wife or persuade someone to die and leave him a fat legacy, said Francesca. Since MPs have to become the recipients of a salary, rather more is expected and demanded of them in the expenditure line than before. Yes, the House of Commons still remains rather at the opposite pole to the Kingdom of Heaven as regards entrance qualifications, observed Lady Caroline, who was constantly being witty. There ought to be no difficulty about Ugal picking up a girl with money, said Serena. With his prospects, he would make an excellent husband for any woman with social ambitions. And she half sighed, as though she almost regretted that a previous matrimonial arrangement precluded her from entering into the competition on her own account. Francesca, under an assumption of languid interest, again, notice the use of the word assumption there. It's not the way you would normally use it, I mean almost always. Under, she's assuming a languid interest, assuming like a pose. Notice how much is about aspect, mien, visage, appearance, attitude, assumption, all these things where how people are essentially playing themselves and presenting themselves like an instrument. This is a very, very, very big thing back in those days. Francesca, under an assumption of languid interest, I mean, she assuming a languid interest, a pose of languid interest, was watching Lady Caroline narrowly for some hint of suppressed knowledge of Ugel's courtship of Miss DeFry. Whom are you marrying and giving in marriage? The question came from George St. Michael, who had strayed over from a neighboring table, attracted by the fragments of small talk that had reached his ears. St. Michael was one of those dapper, bird-like, illusorily active men who seem to have been in a certain stage of middle age for as long as human memory can recall them. A close-cut, peaked beard lent a certain dignity to his appearance, alone which the rest of his features and mannerisms were continually and successfully repudiating. His profession, if he had one, was submerged to his hobby in his hobby, which consisted of being an advance agent for small happenings or possible happenings that were or seemed imminent in the social world around him. He found a perpetual and unflagging satisfaction in acquiring and retailing stray items of gossip or information, particularly of a matrimonial nature that chanced to come his way. Given the bare outline of an officially announced engagement, he would immediately fill it in with all manner of details, true or, at any rate, probable, drawn from his own imagination or from some equally exclusive source. The Morning Post might content itself with the mere statement of the arrangement, which would shortly take place, but it was St. Michael's breathless little voice that proclaimed how the contracting parties had originally met over a salmon fishing incident, why the guards' chapel would not be used, why her Aunt Mary had at first opposed the match, how the question of the children's religious upbringing had been compromised, etc., to all whom it might interest and to many whom it might not. Beyond his industriously earned preeminence in this special branch of intelligence, he was chiefly noteworthy for having a wife reputed to be the tallest and thinnest woman in the home counties. The two were sometimes seen together in society, where they passed under the collective name of St. Michael and All Angles. I guess as opposed to All Angels. Wordplay. We are trying to find a rich wife for Courtney Ugel, said Serena in answer to St. Michael's question. Ah, there I'm afraid you're a little late, he observed, glowing with the importance of pending revelation. I'm afraid you're a little late, he repeated, watching the effect of his words as a gardener might watch the development of a bed of carefully tended asparagus. I think the young gentleman has been before you and already found himself a rich maiden prospect. He lowered his voice as he spoke, not with a view to imparting impressive mystery to his statement, but because there were other table groups within hearing to whom he hoped presently to have the privilege of redisclosing his revelation. Do you mean, began Serena. Mr. Fry, broke in St. Michael hurriedly, fearful lest his revelation should be forestalled, even in guesswork. Quite an ideal choice, the very wife for a man who means to make his mark in politics. 24,000 a year, with prospects of more to come, and a charming place of her own, not too far from town. Quite the type of girl, too, who will make a good political hostess. Brains, without being brainy. You know, just the right thing. Of course, it would be premature to make any definite announcement at present. It would hardly be premature for my partner to announce what she means to make trumps, interrupted Lady Caroline in a voice of such sinister gentleness that St. Michael fled headlong back to his own table. Oh, is it me? I beg your pardon. I leave it, said Serena. I guess that means pass. Thank you. No trumps, declared Lady Caroline. The hand was successful, and the rubber ultimately fell to her with a comfortable margin of honors. The same partners cut together again, and this time the cards went distinctly against Francesca and Ada Spelvexit, and a heavily piled-up score confronted them at the close of the rubber. Francesca was conscious that a certain amount of rather erratic play on her part had at least contributed to the result. St. Michael's incursion into the conversation had proved rather a powerful distraction to her ordinarily sound bridgecraft. Ada Spelvexit emptied her purse of several gold pieces and infused a corresponding degree of superiority into her manner. I must be going now, she announced. I'm dining early. I have to give an address to some charwomen afterward, cleaning women. Why? Asked Lady Caroline with a disconcerting directness that was one of her most formidable characteristics. Oh, well, I have some things to say to them that I dare say they will like to hear, said Ada with a thin laugh. Her statement was received with a silence that betokened profound unbelief in any such possibility. I go about a good deal among working-class women, she added. No one has ever said it, observed Lady Caroline, but how painfully true it is that the poor have us always with them. And there she's reversing the ordinary cliché or expression. Then Bible, the poor be with us always. But how painfully true it is that the poor have us always with them. Ada Spelvexit hastened her departure. The marred impressiveness of her retreat came as a culminating discomfiture on the top of her ill fortune at the card table. Possibly, however, the multiplication of her own annoyances enabled her to survey charwomen's troubles with increased cheerfulness. None of them, at any rate, had spent an afternoon with Lady Caroline. Francesca cut in at another table, and with better fortune attending on her, succeeded in winning back most of her losses. A sense of satisfaction was distinctly dominant as she took leave of her hostess. St. Michael's gossip, or rather the manner in which it had been received, had given her a clue to the real state of affairs, which, however slender and conjectural, at least pointed in the desired direction. At first she had been horribly afraid lest she should be listening to a definite announcement which would have been the death blow to her hopes, but as the recitation went on without any of those assured little minor details which St. Michael so loved to supply, she had come to the conclusion that it was merely a piece of intelligent guesswork. And if Lady Caroline had really believed in the story of Elaine de Frey's virtual engagement to Courtenay Ugel, she would have taken a malicious pleasure in encouraging St. Michael in his confidences and in watching Francesca's discomfiture under the recital. The irritated manner in which she had cut short the discussion betrayed the fact that, as far as the old woman's information went, it was Comus and not Courtenay Ugel who had held the field. And in this particular case, Lady Caroline's information was likelier to be nearer the truth than St. Michael's confident gossip. And notice how you can pick the small details and draw big conclusions from them. Francesca always gave a penny to the first crossing sweeper or match seller she chanced across after a successful sitting at bridge. This afternoon, she had come out of the fray some 15 shillings to the bad, but she gave 2 pennies to a crossing sweeper at the northwest corner of Berkeley Square as a sort of thanks offering to the gods. So she thinks her boy is in. That's the end of chapter 7. And now we'll do chapter 8. It was a fresh, rain-repentant afternoon, following a morning that had been sultry and torrentially wet by turns, the sort of afternoon that impels people to talk graciously of the rain having done a lot of good, its chief merit in their eyes probably having been its recognition of the art of moderation. Also, it was an afternoon that invited bodily activity after the convalescent languor of the earlier part of the day. Elaine had instinctively found her way into her riding habit and sent an order down to the stables, a blessed oasis that still smelt sweetly of horse and hay and cleanliness in a world that reeked of petrol. And now she set her mare at a smart pace through a succession of long stretching country lanes. She was due sometime that afternoon at a garden party, but she rode with determination in an opposite direction. In the first place, neither Comus nor Courtenay would be at the party, which fact seemed to remove any valid reason that could be thought of for inviting her attendance thereat. In the second place, about 100 human beings would be gathered there, and human gatherings were not her most crying need at the present moment. Since her last encounter with her wooers under the cedars in her own garden, Elaine realized that she was either very happy or cruelly unhappy. She could not quite determine which. She seemed to have what she most wanted in the world lying at her feet, and she was dreadfully uncertain in her more reflective moments whether she really wanted to stretch out her hand and take it. It was all very like some situation in Arabian Nights or tale or a story of pagan Hellas, Greece, and consequently the more puzzling and disconcerting to a girl brought up on the methodical lines of Victorian Christianity. Her appeal court was in permanent session these last few days, but it gave no decisions, at least none that she would listen to. And the ride on her fast-stepping little mare, alone and unattended, through the fresh-smelling leafy lanes into unexplored country, seemed just what she wanted at the moment. The mare made some small, delicate pretense of being road-shy, not the staring, dolt-like kind of nervousness that shows itself in an irritating hanging back as each conspicuous wayside object presents itself, but the nerve flutter of an imaginative animal that merely results in a quick whisk of the head and a swifter bound forward. She might have paraphrased the mental attitude of the immortalized Peter Bell into 3 lines, poetry, a basket underneath a tree, a yellow tiger is to me, if it is nothing more. The more really alarming episodes of the road, the hoot and whir of a passing motor car, or the loud vibrating hum of a wayside threshing machine, were treated with indifference. On turning a corner out of a narrow coppice-bordered lane into a wider road that sloped steadily upward in a long stretch of hill, Elaine saw, coming toward her at no great distance, a string of yellow-painted vans, drawn for the most part by skewbald or speckled horses. A certain rakish air about these oncoming road craft proclaimed them as belonging to a traveling wild beast show, decked out in the rich primitive coloring that one's taste in childhood would have insisted on before it had been schooled in the artistic value of dullness. It was an unlooked-for and distinctly unwelcome encounter. The mare had already commenced a sixfold scrutiny with nostrils, eyes, and daintily pricked ears. One ear made hurried little backward movements to hear what Elaine was saying about the eminent niceness and respectability of the approaching caravan, but even Elaine felt that she would be unable satisfactorily to explain the elephants and camels that could certainly form part of the procession. To turn back would seem rather craven, and the mare might take fright at the maneuver and try to bolt. A gate standing ajar at the entrance to a farmyard lane provided a convenient way out of the difficulty. As Elaine pushed her way through, she became aware of a man standing just inside the lane who made a movement forward to open the gate for her. "Thank you, I'm just getting out of the way of a wild beast show," she explained. My mare is tolerant of motors and traction engines, but I expect camels. Hello. She broke off, recognizing the man as an old acquaintance. I heard you had taken rooms in a farmhouse somewhere. Fancy meeting you in this way. In the not very distant days of her little girlhood, Tom Caraway had been a man to be looked upon with a certain awe and envy. Indeed, the glamour of his roving career, would have fired the imagination and wistful desire to do likewise of many young Englishmen. It seemed to be the grown-up realization of the games played in dark rooms in winter firelit evenings and the dreams dreamed over favorite books of adventure. Making Vienna his headquarters, almost his home, he had rambled where he had listed, through the lands of the Near and Middle East, as leisurely and thoroughly as tamer souls might explore Paris. He had wandered through Hungarian horse fairs, hunted shy, crafty beasts on loose, lonely Balkan hillsides. I think I recall someone very similar to this in a short story. Dropped himself pebble-wise into the stagnant human pool of some Bulgarian monastery, threaded his way through the strange racial mosaic of Salonika, listened with amused politeness to the shallow, ultra-modern opinions of a voluble editor or lawyer in some wayside Russian town, or learned wisdom from a chance tavern companion, one of the atoms of the busy ant stream of men and merchandise that moves untiringly round the shores of the Black Sea. And far and wide as he might roam, he always managed to turn up at frequent intervals at ball and supper and theater in the gay Hauptstadt of the Habsburgs, haunting his favorite cafes and wine vaults, skimming through his favorite news sheets, greeting old acquaintances and friends, from ambassadors down to cobblers in the social scale. He seldom talked of his travels, but it might be said that his travels talked of him. There was an air about him that a German diplomat once summed up in a phrase, "a man that wolves have sniffed at." And then two things happened, which he had not mapped out in his route. A severe illness shook half the life and all the energy out of him, and a heavy money loss brought him almost to the door of destitution. With something, perhaps, of the impulse which drives a stricken animal away from its kind, Tom Caraway left the haunts where he had known so much happiness, I guess Vienna, and withdrew into the shelter of a secluded farmhouse lodging. More than ever, he became to Elaine a hearsay personality. And now the chance meeting with the caravan had flung her across the threshold of his retreat. "What a charming little nook you've got hold of," she exclaimed with instinctive politeness, and then looked searchingly around and discovered that she had spoken the truth. It really was charming. The farmhouse had that intensely English look that one seldom sees out of Normandy. Over the whole scene of rickyard, garden, outbuildings, horse pond, and orchard brooded that air which seems rightfully to belong to out-of-the-way farmyards, an air of wakeful dreaminess which suggests that here man and beast and bird have got up so early that the rest of the world has never caught up with them and never will. Elaine dismounted, and Caraway led the mare round to a little paddock by the side of a great gray barn. At the end of the lane, they could see the show go past, a string of lumbering vans and great striding beasts that seemed to link the vast silences of the desert with the noises and sights and smells, the naphtha flares and advertisement hoardings and trampled orange peel of an endless succession of towns. "You'd better let the caravan pass well on its way before you get on the road again," said Caraway. "The smell of the beasts may make your mare nervous and restive going home." Then he called to a boy who was busy with a hoe among some defiantly prosperous weeds to fetch the lady a glass of milk and a piece of currant loaf. "I don't know when I've seen anything so utterly charming and peaceful," said Elaine, propping herself on a seat that a pear tree had obligingly designed in the fantastic curve of its trunk. "Charming, certainly," said Caraway, "but too full of the stress of its own little life struggle to be peaceful. Since I have lived here, I've learnt what I've always suspected, that a country farmhouse, set away in a world of its own, is one of the most wonderful studies of interwoven happenings and tragedies that can be imagined. It is like the old chronicles of medieval Europe in the days when there was a sort of ordered anarchy between feudal lords and overlords and burggrafs and mitred abbots and prince bishops, robber barons and merchant guilds and electors and so forth, all striving and contending and counterplotting and interfering with each other under some vague code of loosely applied rules. Here one sees it reproduced under one's eyes, like a musty page of blackletter come to life. Look at one little section of it, the poultry life on the farm. Villa poultry, dull egg machines with records kept of how many ounces of food they eat, how many pennies worth of eggs they lay, give you no idea of the wonder life of these farm birds, their feuds and jealousies and carefully maintained prerogatives, their unsparing tyrannies and persecutions, their calculated courage and bravado or sedulously hidden cowardice. It might all be some human chapter from the annals of the old Rhineland or medieval Italy. And then, outside their own bickering wars and hates, the grim enemies that come up against them from the woodlands, the hawk that dashes among the coops like a moss trooper raiding the border, knowing well that a charge of shot may tear him to bits at any moment, and the stoat, a creeping slip of brown fur a few inches long, intently and unstably out for blood, and the hunger-taught master of craft, the red fox, who has waited perhaps half the afternoon for his chance while the fowls were dusting themselves under the hedge, and just as they were turning supperward to the yard, one has stopped a moment to give her feathers a final shake and found death springing upon her. "Do you know," he continued, as Elaine fed herself and the mare with morsels of currant loaf, "I don't think any tragedy in literature that I have ever come across impressed me so much as the first one that I spelled out slowly for myself in the words of three letters. The bad fox has got the red hen." There was something so dramatically complete about it. The badness of the fox, added to all the traditional guile of his race, seemed to heighten the horror of the hen's fate. And there was such a suggestion of masterful malice about the word God. One felt that a countryside in arms would not get that hen away from the bad fox. They used to think me a slow, dull reader for not getting on with my lesson, but I used to sit and picture to myself the red hen with its wings beating helplessly, screeching in terrified protest, or perhaps, if he had got it by the neck, with a beak wide agape and silent, the eyes staring as if left the farmyard forever. I have seen blood spilling and down crushing and abject defeat here and there in my time, but the red hen has remained in my mind as the type of helpless tragedy. We would probably say archetype today, but type. He was silent for a moment, as if he were again musing over the three-letter drama that had so dwelt in his childhood's imagination. "Tell me some of the things you have seen in your time," was the request that was nearly on Elaine's lips, but she hastily checked herself and substituted another. "Tell me more about the farm, please." And he told her of a whole world, or rather of several intermingled worlds, set apart in this sleepy hollow in the hills, of beast lore and wood lore and farmcraft, at times touching almost the border of witchcraft, passing lightly here, not with the probing eagerness of those who know nothing, but with the averted glance of those who fear to see too much. He told her of those things that slept, and those that prowled when the dusk fell, of strange hunting cats, of the yard swine and the stalled cattle, of the farm folk themselves, as curious and remote in their way, in their ideas and fears and wants and tragedies, as the brutes and feathered stock that they tended. It seemed to Elaine as if a musty store of old-world children's books had been fetched down from some cobweb lumber room and brought to life. Sitting there in the little paddock, grown thickly with tall weeds and rank grasses and shadowed by the weather-beaten old gray barn, listening to this chronicle of wonderful things, half fanciful, half very real, she could scarcely believe that a few miles away there was a garden party in full swing with smart frocks and smart conversation, fashionable refreshments and fashionable music, and a fevered undercurrent of social strivings and snubbings. Did Vienna and the Balkan Mountains and the Black Sea seem as remote and hard to believe in, she wondered, to the man sitting by her side who had discovered or invented this wonderful fairyland? Was it a true and merciful arrangement of fate and life that the things of the moment thrust out the aftertaste of the things that had been? Here was one who had held much that was priceless in the hollow of his hand and lost it all. And he was happy and absorbed and well content with the little wayside corner of the world into which he had crept. And Elaine, who held so many desirable things in the hollow of her hand, could not make up her mind to be even moderately happy. She did not even know whether to take this hero of her childhood down from his pedestal or to place him on a higher one. On the whole, she was inclined to resent rather than approve the idea that ill health and misfortune could so completely subdue and tame an erstwhile bold and roving spirit. The mare was showing signs of delicately hinted impatience. The paddock, with its teasing insects and very indifferent grazing, had not thrust out the image of her own comfortable, well-foddered loose box. Elaine divested her habit of some remaining crumbs of bun loaf and jumped lightly onto her saddle. As she rode slowly down the lane, with Caraway escorting her as far as its gate, she looked round at what had seemed to her a short while ago just a picturesque old farmstead, a place of beehives and hollyhocks and gabled cart sheds. Now it was, in her eyes, a magic city, with an undercurrent of reality beneath its magic. "You are a person to be envied," she said to Caraway. "You have created a fairyland, and you are living in it yourself." "Envied?" He shot the question out with sudden bitterness. She looked down and saw the wistful misery that had come into his face. "Once," he said to her, "in a German paper, I read a short story about a tame, crippled crane that lived in the park of some small town. I forget what happened in the story, but there was one that I shall always remember. It was lame. That's why it was tame. It was lame. That is why it was tame." He had created a fairyland, but assuredly he was not living in it. And that's the end of chapter 9. I'm not going to attempt to interpret that in any way. That was the end of chapter 8. So we'll cut it there for today. That's chapter 7 and chapter 8. We'll just keep going two at a time, unless the last might be odd, and we'll do 3 to finish it. But again, I've been Alex Linder, reading to you from Saki's The Unbearable Bassington, and this was chapters 7 and 8. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again for more real soon.